Hello, you Awakening Wonders. They're on Spotify, Apple, Stink Whistle, Gurgle Dot, or wherever you download your podcast these days to remain at least peripherally connected to some tendril of truth in a bewildering miasma of lies and propaganda. We appreciate you and we love you. You're part of our community. So that's why we're very happy to give you an audio version of our live Rumble show 5 days a week. It's on Monday to Friday. We decipher the latest news stories. We break down current topics that the mainstream media should be covering. And if they aren't, then we critique why they're not and what they are covering. Every week as well, right? We do brilliant conversations with people like Jordan Peterson, RFK, Tucker Carlson, Sam Harris, Vandana Shiva, Gabor Mate. These things are already up and you can listen to them now. So remember, this is an audio version of our daily live show. To tune in live, go to rumble.com/Russell Brand. You'll find it easily and I hope that you will love it. Now please enjoy this episode of Stay Free with Russell Brand. Thanks.
No, here's the fucking news.
Hello there, you Awakening Wonders. Thanks for joining me today for Stay Free with Russell Brand. It's a very special show because we've got Mike Benz back again. Mike Benz, understands the architecture of the deep state and its application. He's a former state official himself, and whilst he didn't invent the term blob, by God, does he use it accurately. He was one of the first voices that came out in support of me explaining how the legacy media, deep state and NGOs operate when it comes to shutting down dissent. I'm going to have a great conversation with Mike today. We're going to talk about the Trusted News Initiative, the concoction of media organisations that collaborate together in order to ensure that there's one narrative and the independent media gets shut down. We're going to talk about what the deep state is in essence, and I'm going to be passing on Kay Cotwars, he's an Awakened Wonders, question about what is the aim of the deep state? Who are these guys working for? If you just tapped him on the shoulder and said, what are you doing all this deep state witchcraftery and chicanery for? Who benefits if you're not working for the people? If you're not working for God, who do you work for? Who benefits? Who is Kaiser Soze? You know the kind of thing. If you're watching us anywhere other than our home on Rumble, remember, we'll just be there for 10-15 minutes. You can't speak as freely as Mike Benz does, spitting truths that are going to shatter holes in the dome of intrusion and confusion that the state puts in front of your mind, mate. No, you have to get that kind of stuff in the sweet stream of freedom we call Rumble. If you're an Awakened Wonder, then you can join us live for these conversations and even pass on your questions to Mike to show that he can do this stuff live. If you use the code I Surrender, you get 1 month free and you get to see our exclusive videos. This week's on Operation Mockingbird, which is another subject that Mike's going to educate us about. Because when do these conspiracy theories become conspiracy fact, and how long will they maintain that that's even a legitimate term? As if a conspiracy theory is some rare thing, some lime green butterfly, rather than an ordinary moth devouring the very fabric of our society. Without any more analogy, allegory or metaphor, let's get into what we came here for. It's Mike Benz. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Russell. That was epic.
I'm so happy to see you again. I often talk to people in my community and team about the video you made at the point where my attacks truly kicked in. Sadly, that day you were wearing a hat that's less than ideal. Otherwise, I would be using it as one of the key artifacts to demonstrate how the deep state and legacy media interests cooperate to bring down dissenting voices, even if particular members of it aren't really aware that that's what they're doing. You know, the state is so sprawling and so vast, these interests so powerful, that there are perfectly reasonable people sort of wandering around, I'm involved in activism, I'm doing a good thing. How diffuse are these interests? How do they truly work? And I wonder if you can give us a clear example of, just take, you know, like the takedown of a dissident voice, a clear example of how these interests are able to cooperate and how the cartilage of NGOs works. I remember you're very good on that and you've been very articulate on that subject before. Give us a few examples before we jump into this extraordinary subject.
Yeah, sure. Maybe we can start with that cartilage concept, which is a really great way to sort of visualize how state control over media works. So at the end of World War II, a so-called rules-based international order was constructed. You may have heard this phrase bandied about by folks who are involved in the government or who are involved in sort of official media. They refer to the rules-based international order, which was constructed about 1947, 1948, in the aftermath of World War II, and sort of in between it. We had Bretton Woods in 1942 to 1944. We had the Marshall Plan for Reconstruction of Europe in the 1940s. We had the IMF and World Bank set up. We had the UN set up to tie all the countries together. And we had something called the UN Universal Declaration on Human Rights, which promised national sovereignty to every country on Earth as a fundamental right. And within that was a formal prohibition under international law of the acquisition of another country by military force. So the age of empire that existed from the Roman times all the way up until World War II, where you would maintain an empire or you would acquire an empire by sending your military in to take over a territory, became a violation of international law. And so our traditional military and spycraft structures had to switch to another method to achieve a functional territorial acquisition. And that was through political control over a country, or sometimes referred to political, economic, and informational control, which is now known as soft power. So hard power being military, soft power being getting a country under your control because its political leaders are under your control, its courts are under your control, its educational systems are under your control. And one of the main methods to achieve that control is controlling the media ecosystems within that country. That way the masses of people, its leaders, its courts, all of its decision-making bodies are essentially on brand with whatever the talking points being piped in from U.S. government sponsored media were saying. And so starting in 1947, we created in the U.S. the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and we restructured our entire spycraft intelligence apparatus along something that was called the plausible deniability doctrine. And you know, the great starting place for this is one of the godfathers of the CIA. His name was George Kennan. He posted a memo to this is one of the very first National Security Council documents we have in this country. It's called the Inauguration of Organized Political Warfare in 1948. This is right after the CIA, 12 days after the CIA rigged the Italian election in Italy using dirty tricks, stuffing ballot boxes, importing swarms of media, working with both the church and with mafia groups who they had a liaison relationship with to overthrow Mussolini. And so George Kennan writes a memo saying, listen, we need to start looking at warfare as being political warfare. We need to undergo what he called the inauguration of organized political warfare, a fundamental restructuring of our power projection to engage in organized political warfare on every country on Earth in order to swing it into our influence. And if we don't do it, the Bolsheviks are going to do it. So somebody's got to be doing the dirty work. We know America has not traditionally done this in any sort of organized fashion, but this is the new way war has to be done after this UN Declaration on Human Rights. And so with that kickoff, we embarked on a mass, quote, capacity building. This is the phrase that they use in order to get media organizations under CIA or State Department control. And just so you understand, the plausible deniability doctrine was this idea that State Department wanted to do this dirty work directly. The State Department is one of the, in 1789, when the U.S. had our first meeting of Congress, we created three agencies. We created the State Department, at the time it was called the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, it's now called the State Department, to manage the American empire and its assets. We created the War Department, which was changed its name in 1948 to the Defense Department, again to create this false sort of messaging that we're actually not engaged in warfare abroad, we're engaged in forward defense. We're not taking over your country through war, we are just forward defending ourselves on your turf. And then the third agency that was constructed in that first meeting of Congress was the U.S. Treasury. You know, basically, so our money system, our military, and our empire, our State Department management were all created, you know, at the foundation of America in our first meeting of our Congress. So when the Department of War changed its name to the Department of Defense and the CIA was created with this plausible deniability doctrine, it was explicitly created under this plausible deniability doctrine under this NSC memo 10-2, which gave the CIA carte blanche to rig elections, to control media, to engage in sabotage, to engage in demolitions, to engage in all manner of black propaganda or subversion, so long as they maintain so-called plausible deniability that quote, even if it were discovered, it would not be traceable to the U.S. government. So understand, there's a concept of that we call diplomacy, which is a very euphemistic word for control or power projection around the world. And we have two branches of the U.S. government, essentially, that two agencies that are charged with our diplomacy. The State Department does overt diplomacy, and the CIA does covert diplomacy. But the two are one iceberg. And they operate to synchronize with each other such that if there are things that we need to do on the power projection front that State Department wants, but State Department doesn't want attributed to the State Department, such as, say, blowing up a pipeline at the bottom of the Baltic Sea or getting tens of thousands of people in a foreign country on U.S. payroll so that they're financially bribed to print pro-U.S. media, We get the CIA to coordinate that, or at least that was the original structure. And so what was created at the time was called Wisner's-Wurlitzer. Wisner's-Wurlitzer was Frank Wisner, who is one of the sort of founding architects of the CIA. And he bragged that he was able to play thousands of media outlets around the world like a Wurlitzer, which is sort of like a church organ, you know, one of these sort of multi-layered pianos that you could theoretically play with octopus hands. And so this, at the time, the U.S. had a huge first mover advantage together with Britain in media, which is that we had a first mover advantage in radio. We had a first mover advantage in TV programming. And the U.S. and Britain had, you know, the largest capacities for print media as well. And so on virtually every country on Earth and every continent, the CIA at the time was working directly, funneling money through foundations to create, you know, often using, you know, Cayman Island bank accounts or using offshore bank accounts starting in the 1950s to do this, through foundations to then funnel money to media organizations on all six populated continents. And then the issue was Vietnam happened, and there began to be a major dissent within the U.S. for CIA and Pentagon priorities. Now, again, the CIA had boots on the ground in Vietnam 7 years before we sent in the boys with the military. And the problem was domestic political actors were forming against this foreign policy, State Department, CIA, DOD agenda. And all of it collapses if you don't get citizen funding, because it's all paid for by the taxpayers. So if people decide in domestic politics to vote against or to not fund the priorities of the blob, the foreign policy establishment, then the blob dies. The blob dies on the vine. And so what the CIA started to do in the 1960s and 70s is turn that Wisner's Wurlitzer apparatus inside to use media assets at, you know, 400 some different media institutions, as well as even bribing student groups on college campuses in order to get people to support the infinite war apparatus. And then I can get to the next evolution of this, because that structure crumbled in 1975, but it reformed in 1983, and we're living in the aftermath of that. And that's really where it starts to get interesting. But I'll pause there, because I've been going for a while, if you have specific questions on that.
Thank the Lord for our magnificent commercial partners. True Lean, loyal, decent, fine product. Support them if you can. True Lean's Everyday Wellness, which is an all-natural 9-in-1 powder that boosts immune health, reduces inflammation, promotes gut health, including vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin B12, zinc, turmeric, and echinacea, is a potion of pure wonder. Everyday Wellness, backed by science, inspired by Mother Nature herself. All you got to do is stir these sachets into water and enjoy. Unless you've got one of these glorious big bags. Look, this is like the parent. There it's sort of like cells that are within it. There it's infants, it's tadpoles, as it were. Control your health without prescription. Take that, Big Pharma. I'm feeling better already, and I can just feel Pfizer's stock price plummeting. Spicy citrus tastes like sipping on sunshine. Let me have a sip of that sunshine. The inner light of the Lord is shining from within me. You can visit Trulene.com, code BRAND25 for 25% off. Use the code BRAND25, get 25% off. They'll know we work. I'll tell you what it feels like. It's spicy. It gives you a zing. It's life itself. Now, I'm sorry, my brothers and sisters, my aunts and uncles in Europe, this is only available in the United States of America. If you get some of this, if you don't feel the benefit within 30 days, Trulene will buy it back from you. Even if the bag's empty, you can send them this empty bag. You could even put something in there. I don't know. A stool, a rabbit's paw. They'll give you your money back. That's how confident they are in this product. Try everyday wellness for yourself today. You deserve it. Trulene.com. Use the code BRAND25 for 25% off. Let them know I sent you. It works well for us. God, this stuff's delicious. I can't get enough of it, but then I have an addictive personality. Let's get back to the content.
Bloody hell, Mike. I mean, all we'd have to do is memorize what you just said in the first 14 minutes of our show, and we would have an understanding of the inception and execution of the deep state apparatus, how it pertains to foreign policy, media control, and the acquisition of citizen funding. What an extraordinarily comprehensive answer. I've got, obviously, a good number of follow-up questions, and I appreciate the fact that you could have carried on speaking for the entirety of our hour, and it would have not once been boring. But even you need the occasional guzzle of Fiji water to keep the machine running. A few things that I want to check in on is that when you sort of touched upon the extraction of Mussolini and the CIA, and I think you said the church possibly participate in his removal, it seems that there were points where these agencies, or in particular that one, could legitimize their actions, at least unless there's something I'm missing, by saying what we're doing is favorable, is advantageous to American interests. And one might even argue, I'm sure, I don't know, maybe I'm in for a new shock, that it generally and genuinely good. The removal of Mussolini was surely good, although I recognise he was very popular in his nation and he seemed to be in tune with his times. He was an old school fascist. I love too, in your answer, how you described the inception of the rule-based order and the establishment of these triple-letter organisations and bureaucracies, the IMF, or single double-letter in the case of the UN, and I'm imagining the WHO's not far behind, even if it's sort of historically subsequent to the advent of those other agencies, and how that aligns with my broad and certainly nowhere near as articulate or as well-informed as your understanding that these new bureaucracies and legislative entities are what we ought fear now, in the way that we are being coached by the very legacy media that you are apparently instructing us are to at least some degree guided by and controlled by the forces that you just outlined and described. They will point our fear, stoke our fear, escalate our anxiety, that what we ought be concerned about is the emergence of nationalist demagogues, populists that appear to be 21st century reincarnations of e.g. Mussolini, Stalin, Hitler. But actually, no, it's to the literature of that time we can look now, or the near contemporaneous literature, the writing of Huxley, Orwell, and even Kafka, who seem to intuit that what would happen is administrative powers that are invisible and difficult to discern would insidiously seep like fog under your door into your life. And two examples of that that I'm fond of using are, if you ever interface with YouTube, and I'd love to ask you about CIA involvement with Google, Alphabet, that when you interface with them, there's a kind of HAL from 2001 style anodyne banality to their communication. The team have decided that you are demonetized and we cannot help you at this time. Or another example of this kind of bureaucratic power is a WHO treaty that says that we are here to help you and all we need to do is bypass your national sovereignty. All we need is access to your budget, the ability to inoculate, the ability to censor, curiously enough. You know, Gil Scott-Heron may have said the revolution will not be televised, but the force that we need to revolt against will not even come with identifiable semiotics or identifiable characters, not so much as a poster of Big Brother to warn us that we are facing horror. So, in outlining your doubtless epic answer, could you talk us through the inception of big tech and social media? Because it's impossible to think that anything could be that powerful without the involvement of the powers you describe. How the somewhat innocent Wisner's Wurlitzer has become the Zuckerberg zoetrope, or whatever it is we're confronted with now, as big tech commingles with this kind of power. And how, what you've told us the history, how has it evolved into the technological age and become more powerful, starting perhaps with the relationships between big tech, social media, and the deep state, please? Before you answer that question, Mike, we're going to have to leave YouTube for the rest of this fantastic interview. I truly believe that if you watch this interview like five times, memorized it, you'd be able to have a conversation with anybody. He's going to help you to understand the origins of the CIA, the funding of Google, Jared Cohen's curious role. There's so much to learn from this. So click the link in the description and we'll see you for the rest of this conversation on Rumble.
Perfect. Yeah. So let's get to the origins of Google. So, there's a funny story about the internet, because when you're referring to big tech, we're talking about the big tech internet companies, primarily here, so like Google. And, they're all based on the internet, and the internet was created by the American military in order to manage the American empire. It was created by DARPA in the 1960s in order to digitize and be able to quickly share within the military all of the social science research that was being funded by the Eisenhower administration and the Kennedy administration to be able to do anthropological and social science research, the reams of academic work that the military was paying academics to produce on foreign populations who were posing insurgency concerns to U.S. installed dictators in different regions, or to U.S. managed governments, after we had begun to territorially acquire all these different countries during the Cold War. And there were student revolts on college campuses in the 1960s against the internet before the internet even went private, because the internet, the World Wide Web, the private internet that all of us use, was not debuted until 1991, December 1990. But even in the 1960s, people realized that the computer was an instrument of U.S. statecraft. In fact, during these sort of anti-Vietnam protests at MIT, there, you can even look for this if you run a search for this on your favorite search engine, something called they were revolting against what they called the octoputer. The idea that the computer and this DARPA-funded internet was going to be used as a world-spanning octopus power for the military to control other countries that student groups were accusing of being subject to U.S. imperialism. Now, what happened was, in 1991, the World Wide Web rolls out, and DARPA turns over the internet to the National Science Foundation and projects that through a bunch of universities to make it publicly available for commercial use. But the other side of this is that it was being used for soft power projection. See, at the start, when I was describing Wisner's Wurlitzer, the CIA created a bunch of proprietary media organizations like Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia. These were all radio and then television programming that would project U.S. media and also pay media organizations within foreign countries to produce pro-U.S. propaganda. And that was a very easy thing to do when there were only a couple of different radio frequencies available in that country, or that country wasn't producing its own native content, its own native TV content. As other countries caught up to us in the other modalities of media soft power, competition, the promise of the new internet for the State Department, the military, and the CIA was that this would be sort of like a new radio, a new TV, a new Voice of America, a new channel where America had first mover advantage, because it was all the American internet. And so right away, as soon as the internet came out, DARPA commissioned a program called the Massive Digital Data Systems Program. And the Massive Digital Data Systems Program was a joint project of the NSA and the CIA in order to track how, quote, birds of a feather flock together online. And their goal was to create what they referred to as a early warning political radar system to be able to track how political groups around the world were rising and falling and how they were congregating together on the internet. Because in Web 1.0, you had web forums and you had these static web pages. And so you could track what groups in country X were accessing or maintaining these websites. And you could use that to draw a network map of an entire political movement that you either wanted to run CIA support to, or you wanted to the CIA to crush through counterinsurgency. And part of this involved tracking search results through the early search engines that were created to be able to navigate this new internet. And this is where Google comes into the picture. In 1995, Larry Page and Sergey Brin are PhD students at Stanford, and their PhD is being sponsored essentially by DARPA. They had a DARPA grant to do this search engine aggregation work. And that DARPA grant meant that they were reporting to their grant administrator, which was ultimately the CIA and the NSA. They would then take this work that they got the CIA NSA grant to do to form a company called Google in 1998. So right from the outset, Google was a military and CIA and statecraft, let's say dual use technology, shall we say. And even all of Google's first mover advantages were based on this. Google quickly came out with very innovative product sets like Google Maps, a sort of first of its kind ability to be able to just plug in an address and know how to get there, or go anywhere on Earth and zoom in on it. Well, Google didn't just, brainiacs sitting in a garage, come up with the code for that. They got Google Maps by purchasing the CIA's keyhole satellite software. So it was the CIA's spy satellite software that is the only reason Google got Google Maps. Now, Google's global operations work is based on this as well. So one of the reasons that censorship set in across Google search results and across YouTube is because of a fundamental restructuring of how Google operated beginning after the 2016 U.S. presidential election, started a little bit before that with the story of a guy named Jared Cohen. Jared Cohen, so let's just take a step back and look at the history of social media. You had Facebook in 2004, YouTube in 2005, Twitter in 2006, smartphone in 2007. In 2007, a young kid named Jared Cohen arrives at the inner sanctum of the State Department. It's a place called the Policy Planning Staff. As I mentioned, in my sort of opening salvo, the iceberg of American diplomacy has overt, policies and strategies from the State Department and covert from the CIA. And so they together form a united front of U.S. diplomacy, which means the dirty tricks from the covert side have to be constantly synchronized with the overt actions of the State Department. So that if you're trying to regime change, the country's government, the State Department has to know that and know exactly what's going on when they go in, when they send a delegation to that foreign country's government for their demands or what they want. That synchronization process happens at the policy planning staff. That's that inner cell within the State Department that coordinates the CIA and the State Department. And this is a place that's normally occupied by the sort of wise old men, 50, 60, 70-year-old, fuddy-duddies. Jared Cohen got there at about the age 25, 26. Young kid, but he was brought on by the Bush administration because he had created something called movements.org. And he was embedded basically from his late teen years into the highly volatile youth movements that were being essentially sponsored by the CIA in Middle East, North Africa, in these conflict zones. And because it's so important to instrumentalize student groups and youth groups for color revolutions in U.S. statecraft, he was brought in as essentially a young guy who's hip to what the kids are doing these days, so that that could be folded into American statecraft for how best to exploit those young people. And what Jared Cohen did is he gets in around 2006, 2007, and he looks around at these older guys and he says, what are we doing formulating CIA activities out of U.S. embassies or U.S. consulates or CIA station houses? All the groups we want to mobilize are on Facebook. They're on Twitter. They're on YouTube. We need a doctrine of digital statecraft, statecraft 2.0, to be able to run intelligence operations using social media. And this became the absolute talk of the town of Washington, and he became an overnight celebrity with this concept. He was considered so valuable to not just the Bush administration and Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State there, as a Republican appointee, but his work was considered so vital, the CIA's use of social media, that he was kept over by the Democrats when Barack Obama won the 2008 election and Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State. This is extremely unusual in Washington, let me tell you. When a political appointee is kept over from the next administration. And so he then was effectively credited with starting the Arab Spring, which was a State Department and CIA-sponsored series of Facebook and Twitter revolutions stretching from Tunisia to Egypt, which were said to be the sort of high point of digital democracy when hashtags and Facebook groups were used to coordinate tens of millions of people to take to the streets to overthrow governments that were deemed to be hostile to U.S. interests. At that point, Jared Cohen could have done anything. He was voted by Time Magazine as one of the most powerful, top 50 most powerful people in Washington at the age of 30. But he left in the heat of all of that. People were saying, this kid's going to be president one day. He could have done anything. But he goes over and basically stuns the Beltway crowd by moving in 2010 to a tiny little one-person nonprofit within a mid-sized tech company called Google. At the time in 2010, Google was only ranked number 120 by market cap in terms of US companies. They were not even a top 100 sized company in 2010. And he was poached by Google, as the story goes, in order to sit in a room all day, stare at a white wall, and think by himself about all the creative ways that Google could use its proprietary data and resources to solve complex geopolitical problems. Julian Assange would later term this transition the moment that Google became the shadow State Department. And this came out in Stratfor documents and WikiLeaks when, you know, basically CIA contractors were openly speculating that Jared Cohen's move from policy planning staff at State to Google was a way to synchronize what the CIA was doing with Google resources. Now, this becomes very important to the internet censorship story because this one-person think tank, Google Ideas, would later be rebranded Google Jigsaw. And Google Jigsaw was initially doing sort of a lot of free speech tech work, so that dissident groups being backed by the CIA and State Department would be able to freely proliferate their media influence in regions where there's state control over media, like Iran or like Egypt. But in 2016, Google Jigsaw took on a new power for censorship. Censorship of political movements that were giving rise to leaders like Donald Trump in the US, also on the left-wing populist side like Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, who were NATO skeptical, all the different populist parties in Europe, in India, in Pakistan, in Japan. And so Google Jigsaw became this kind of CIA intermediated censorship octopus, and it created what was essentially the world's first retail, what I call weapons of mass deletion, AI censorship superpowers to be able to scan and ban tens of billions of posts when it created, in the immediate aftermath of the 2016 election, something called Perspective, which rates every post essentially on the internet by a toxicity score that can be used to automatically throttle it from public view. There's a lot more there, but I'll just pause.
Jesus Christ, Jared. I mean, Mike, there's a lot there. I feel like you're going to get killed. That's my main reason. That's my first response is you're going to be killed and you're going to get us all killed. Because that's too cogent and too clear and too plain. Thanks very much. Okay. So, what I feel is that you've actually, you yourself have provided what I asked for, the cartilage that demonstrates how the anatomy of the deep state not only is connected, but is able to coherently move as a single entity. And something like, as you described, the transition of Jared Cohen from working for successive administrations, where he's working with figures like Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, right into sitting in a room staring at a wall like some extraordinary mystic. It, in fact, it's beyond a revolving door, isn't it, at that point? There is no door. There is, it's just one single, well, as you say, blob. Now, you've given me a pretty cohesive understanding, and you've helped me to understand things like how, like when Li Fang did some journalism on how myself and Greenwald and the guys at Grey Zone are being subject to attacks by a CIA carve out operating out of Ukraine, like apparently independent Ukrainian media, that when you look into it, the funding comes from the CIA. Then now this has become so sophisticated and diffuse, sort of molecular, I suppose, is a way of describing it. Like, yeah, like you say, a blob is good because it just fills spaces. It moves around. It's difficult to locate a center. And I know that you could unpack a great deal there, but I wanted to pivot slightly because you've helped me to understand to a degree the inception of those agencies, how they intersect with big tech, in particular, internet and social media companies, search engines, and in essence, how that data, because I remember reading once in Legacy Media, Mike, like there was this magical moment after prior to 9/11, there was a moment where censorship, where people were like, internet privacy is a thing, but after 9/11, it's like, hey, we need that data to track terrorists. And Google sort of realized, oh wow, we've got all of this information. And I recognize that that's probably some sort of counter narrative to sort of mask the fact that what's clearly happened from the point where the, you know, the proprietors and founders were PhD students, they were involved with the CIA. There's no way that anything of that scale, anything of that influence and power was ever beyond the purview and remit of the type of power that we're describing. Another thing I want to touch on, even though it's tangential, of course, pick up anything that's been inspired by my response to your last announcement, was... when people say, like, that, just take a few examples, that George Soros and Bill Gates are, like, actually evil. Like, I, you know, with Bill Gates, I got my own understanding, the significance of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, their influence over something like the WHO, their investment in vaccines, their acquisition of farmland, their misadventures in India and on the continent of Africa when it comes to agriculture, their promotion of synthetic foods, their odd intrusion into areas of legislature, health policy that doesn't seem right. I have a bit of an understanding when it comes to Bill Gates. Extraordinary that he's another person that's, you know, a tech giant and a tech entrepreneur and a billionaire and a philanthropist. I wonder with George Soros, he was a sort of one of those figures I don't sort of know much about, except like when he's attacked, people say, hey, that's anti-Semitic and it's conspiracy theory. Understand that he's a Jewish man. Pretty recently I heard that when the Clinton Foundation were over in Haiti, ostensibly helping Haiti in a way that in retrospect looks pretty clumsy. We're here to help you. Please get your help off of us. And like the money was spent in all sorts of weird, clumsy ways. And even when you see video footage of a sort of a younger, sleeker Hillary Clinton leading George Soros peculiarly through the wreckage of Haiti, even though that's before many of their subsequent disasters, you feel like, what's going on? Why is this guy there? What's happening? So can you explain to us when these figures that, you know, the defenders of, say, there's nothing to worry about when it comes to Bill Gates, he's just a nice dude, or George Soros, there's no problem there. I mean, I've heard, for example, that George Soros benefits in some way from the conflict between Ukraine and Russia with regard to oil, but I don't understand that, and I wonder if you could help me to understand it, please, Mike.
Let's tie all this together with a comment that I think came from one of the questions on your locals at the start of this, which was, who does the blob work for? You know, I think I forget how you teed that up in the beginning, but I almost think of it, you know, like the Austin Powers scene where he goes, "Who does number two?"
That's a good scene, man. That's one of my favorite scenes. You show that turd who's boss. Now you use his... Right, good. We're on familiar territory. Mike Myers comedy. I feel at home. Yeah, hit me, man.
Obviously, we are facilitated in this endeavor through partnership with our sponsors. Here's Fume.
Fume? Award-winning flavored air device, creating new movement towards better habits. Flavored air is not like vaping, you maniac. Fume draws flavor to your mouth, fills a void that ditching bad habits leaves. Fume. There's no vapor. You can use it anywhere. There ain't no nicotine, neither. And it ain't addictive. What about batteries? Do you need batteries? You don't need batteries. So you don't need to change them because you don't even got none. It's backed by doctors in the USA. I'm talking about doctors. If you can't trust a doctor, like Dr. Anthony Fauci, for example, who can...
Fume fills your lungs with delicious addiction cures.
There are great flavours. My favourite. I want you to guess which is my favourite. You can join in there, but you can't fume. Dogs don't allow to fume. You can choose any one of these flavours. Mint crisp, orange vanilla, or white cranberry. I'm sticking with mint crisp. I'm not a maniac. Fume has served over 150,000 satisfied customers. You can be the next success story. For a limited time, you can use my code RussellBrand for 10% off a journey pack. Head to tryfume.com. That's tryfume.com. Use the code RussellBrand or scan the QR code on screen to save 10% off your order right now today. Fume. Mmm. Try saying fume without saying mmm. Fume. Yeah, you can just about do it, but it's hard. Fume. Thank you, Fume, for sponsoring this video.
Right, because that's actually a great way to look at this, because the execution arm of this transatlantic foreign policy blob is the State Department, the CIA, and the DOD, and its swarm army of tens of thousands of paid assets in the media and in the civil society and university realm and things like this. But they are essentially number two, if you will, working for a class above them who they have a revolving door relationship with, and which is really where people in government make their money and do favors for in order to make their own careers and be able to have their own, you know, put their own kids through private school education and really join an elite class. And that is what I call the corporate and financial donor and drafter class. You might think there's a co-investor class. And before I delve into this, I'll start with a quick analogy from what I just mentioned with Jared Cohen, who I mentioned, you know, started at this, you know, started embedded in essentially CIA hot zones organizing student groups, and then worked directly at the center of synchronizing CIA and State Department color revolutions on social media, then went directly to, you know, to Google's essentially CIA branch. But what did Jared Cohen just do a few short years ago? Moved over from Google Jigsaw to the macroeconomic, asset management branch of Goldman Sachs. He is now one of the highest ranking officials at Goldman Sachs. And so he essentially, as you mentioned, you sort of referred to him as a sort of mystic. You know, he wasn't just like a mystic, you know, sitting in a room staring at a white wall. He was a CIA back channel, a State Department back channel. Well, what he's essentially doing at Goldman Sachs is he's not a mystic, you know, forecasting what's going to rise and fall in terms of economies or assets to invest in around the world. Because he's got this State Department CIA back channel, he allows Goldman Sachs to do what's essentially insider trading at the most macro level. If you know that the military or the State Department or the CIA is going to overthrow a government or privatize an industry, you know, a $1 trillion industry in Venezuela or Ukraine that's owned by the state government, but now it's going to be privatized. So if you're an early investor in that, you're going to your investment is going to go to the moon. You have this corporate and financial overclass where there's a revolving door. Okay, so let's take a step back. What do I mean by donor and drafter class? So let's start with the term drafting. So in a bike race, the ideal strategy is not to be out in front at the start. Even if you're the fastest racer, you don't want to be out in the lead in a bike race, because you are bearing the brunt of the full force of the wind, which slows down your traction. You need to exert more work. In corporate terms, that is killing your profits. If you're out in front, the ideal strategy in a bike race is to be right behind the person in front so that they do the work cutting the wind and you efficiently, with a very, much less amount of energy, get the same place. And then you overtake that person at the end. And so what corporations do, and by proxy, their financial equity and debt holders do, is they draft behind the blob, the government side of the blob. They draft behind the DOD, the War Department, the Pentagon. They draft behind, so for example, when the military moves into Ukraine, they draft behind that. When the State Department goes in and threatens sanctions on a country so that it changes its terms of private enterprise or changes its labor laws to make it cheaper for, they draft behind the State Department. If the CIA is incubating a new emerging leadership class in a country who is going to be favorable to ExxonMobil there, or Walmart there, or an agriculture company there, or a tech company there, they draft behind that. And they also serve as co-investors or donors into those projects, because oftentimes it's not enough for just to have U.S. funded allocations to fund a war project or a foreign assistance project. Like, for example, in Ukraine, there's a big issue about how much funding is enough to actually support Ukraine. So part of what the State Department does is they go around to get co-investors in the project in the region so that Microsoft or Google will sort of co-fund it and provide a top up to get the amount of money needed to do this initiative. And actually a great example of this is something like DIA, the DIA app in Ukraine. This is something that I think the Gray Zone, as you mentioned, published a lot about. This is this digital ID system in Ukraine that Zelensky has made essentially mandatory for all Ukrainian people, and it ties their digital identity to their bank account. It's basically the ultimate way to be able to manage a civilization. And it was created by the USAID, which is a CIA cut. USAID is the major funding organization that straddles the line between the State Department and the CIA. It essentially serves as an above board, public facing State Department adjacency that funnels the money that is used by the CIA. Essentially, when something gets USAID funding, it becomes an asset for our covert diplomacy. And so USAID funded the creation of this app in a partnership with Google, Visa, and American Express, I believe, were the two transaction companies. So Ukraine doesn't have its own sort of sophisticated IT architecture. The State Department, using its diplomacy arm, has now made mandatory the use of a system that Google profits from because it runs the architecture of DIA, and that Visa and American Express profit from because they process all the commercial transactions of now every citizen in Ukraine. So you now have a locked-in, government-backed cartel over every single person in Ukraine for both Amex and Google. And so this becomes a very powerful... Now, when you look at who actually sits on the board of these CIA interstitials. So let's take an example, something called the National Endowment for Democracy is a classic example of this. So when in my first salvo here, I talked about how Wisner's Wurlitzer in the era of sort of CIA control over media 1.0 was 1947 to 1975, 1976, which is when the CIA would directly do this, co-opt media organizations. And then this sort of went down in flames when it all came out in public hearings in the Church Committee and Pike Committee hearings in 1975, 1976. President Jimmy Carter, when he won as a Democrat in 1976, promised to put an end to that. He fired 30% of the CIA's operations branch in a single night and basically kneecapped the ability for the CIA to do this work directly. Reagan comes into office in 1980 and wants to revive the sort of full poisonous fang power of the CIA, but doesn't have the bipartisan support to ram this through Congress. And so Reagan's CIA director, Bill Colby, approaches the Reagan's attorney general, the head of the Justice Department, and says it was a disaster when media groups around the world were seen as being paid as funded by the CIA. So, but What we can do, though, is if we set up a national endowment for democracy promotion and have that be formally firewalled off from the CIA so that it looks like it's just coming from a public endowment. Actually, it's not even public, a private endowment. Then we'll be able to have the same capacities we had from the 1940s to the 1970s, where there won't be CIA fingerprints on it. We'll just intermediate it. We'll just back channel with the heads of the National Endowment for Democracy. And so there was a back and forth between the CIA director, Bill Colby, and the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time, where they came up with the structure that there would be a formal firewall. The National Endowment for Democracy would be a private non-governmental organizations, but that as long as there was Senate Intelligence Committee consent to it, the CIA would effectively direct their operations. And by the way, they're a private non-governmental organization, but they're under the direct oversight of the House Foreign Affairs and Senate Foreign Relations Committees. They're a CIA cutout managed by the State Department. Now the NED, if you look at who's on its board, it's the directors of all these companies. Their board of directors for the National Endowment for Democracy has members of the officers and directors of Google, officers and directors of Amex and Visa, officers and directors of Exxon and Chevron. A great example of this actually is in the run-up to the 2014 Maidan coup, the CIA State Department-sponsored overthrow of the democratically elected government of Ukraine. Whether you agree with that or not, them's just the facts. Victoria Nuland actually gave that speech about how they successfully orchestrated this using $5 billion, 5 billion with a B, in State Department and USAID subsidies to the right-wing, right sector groups in Ukraine who did this. She gave that speech bragging about that $5 million in U.S. financial sponsorship of the coup right at a conference that was right in front of, sponsored by Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Shell. And by the way, those were the exact companies who had invested in the oil and gas space in Ukraine. Chevron had signed in 2013 a $10 billion, again with a B, $10 billion partnership with Naftogaz, the Ukrainian state gas giant, which accounts for an overwhelming majority of Ukraine's national economic sector. Shell had signed a $10 billion, again, a matching $10 billion partnership with Naftogaz in Ukraine, again, with a B. So Halliburton had signed a deal with the Ukrainian government's Naftogaz in order to do all the oil and gas refining of the oil and gas space there. You know who held the rights to the Black Sea shale resources that were basically destroyed when Russia annexed Crimea? All the shale rights to in the Black Sea basin there? It was Burisma. And you know who was on the, you know, not only was Hunter Biden on the board of Burisma, but Hunter Biden himself was on the chairman's advisory board of the NDI, the National Democratic Institute. You know what the NDI is? That's the DNC branch of the NED, which is the CIA cutout created so that the CIA could run money without it having the formal fingerprints of the CIA during the CIA 2.0 restructuring. So Hunter Biden on the board of the CIA cutout, that CIA cutout having on its board the, you know, all of the oil and gas co-investors, were then marshaling the CIA and the DOD, i.e. US taxpayer funding, in order to prop up their investments in the region. And this same blueprint is replicated everywhere. And virtually every multinational corporation on Earth is playing this game and has to play this game to compete with others who are playing it.
My God. So, returning to the initial point, and I don't want to suggest that you didn't answer this question as well as a whole lot of others. Figures like Soros and Gates' power comes from their unique positioning behind the head of the pack, accessing back channels and financially and otherwise benefiting from the types of deals and piloting schemes that you see conducted post coups and within vassal states such as Ukraine is becoming.
Do we have time for me to go like super deep on that?
Go deep.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now this is important to keep in mind because George Soros is not just like a player in this. The annual contributions just to the DNC, in the last election cycle, George Soros contributed $100 million to the DNC. The second biggest donor was only $40 million. So George Soros was 2.5 times bigger than anybody else in terms of a donor. So he dominates the political leadership of the Democrat Party in the U.S. But this is a very much a global story. So let's sort of start with the George Soros origin story. In 1979, George Soros was a partner at a hedge fund in New York who primarily concentrated on doing foreign currency speculation, that is, betting using New York financial firm assets under management on the direction of currencies in Eastern Europe in the middle of the Cold War. He creates the Open Society Foundation as a tax loophole for his children, for Alex Soros, in South Africa in 1979. But then he lucks his way into the windfall of a lifetime when Ronald Reagan becomes president in 1980, and this new doctrine of using NGO statecraft, using the National Endowment for Democracy, as I mentioned, that same thing that Hunter Biden was on the board of, and that was created explicitly by the CIA director to have non-CIA fingerprints on funding of CIA assets. In 1982-83, the NED gets set up, and Reagan expands this doctrine of working through NED cutouts and working through the web of civil society organizations and NGOs to do CIA-backed color revolutions, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, which was the main hot zone of the Cold War. So Hungary, Poland, Germany, these countries were, while the Cold War was global, these exact countries were the biggest hot zones of spy versus spy, of the CIA versus the KGB, and they were the crown jewel of the prize for winning the Cold War. When Hungary toppled its communist government and became part of the sort of NATO Western world, when Poland toppled its government with Lech Walesa and the Solidarity Movement there, and when Germany reunified, George Soros teamed up in the early 1980s when this collaboration was being set up, so that the Open Society Foundations, their offices in all of those different countries would function as State Department and CIA vassals for the student groups and the revolutionary street muscle that would take to the streets in a show of force, or would destabilize or shut down the economy or the governance functions of the ruling communist regime in order to orchestrate those revolutions. So these were, George Soros basically took this open society model and set up basically satellites in all the different regions that the CIA and State Department were running government toppling blueprints in. And so his own universities, his own NGOs, his own sort of civil society organizations were being used in order to help the CIA and State Department overthrow those governments. Well, that's a great gig if you happen to simultaneously be running a hedge fund speculating on the direction of those currencies, because you have an advance 6 month, 12 month, 5 year head start in terms of the direction of that currency, because you know that the CIA is going to overthrow that government and either prop it up or crush it, so you can short it and make a massive, massive windfall, for example, if you know that it's going to be destabilized. And he was tasked by the Reagan State Department to do that destabilization work, and they were getting tens of millions of dollars to help facilitate that, again, through this money network. And so Soros became a darling of this bipartisan blob apparatus. He was best friends with John McCain. John, you may have seen pictures of them where they're so close to each other smiling, you think they're about to start making out. John McCain, by the way, was not just, this very powerful senator for two decades here in the U.S. He was not just the man, who the blob was deciding between in the 2008 presidential election, when the choice was between John McCain and Barack Obama. But John McCain was also the founder and the president for 25 years of the IRI. You know how I mentioned, the Hunter Biden's NDI, the National Democratic Institute, when the NED was created, when the CIA created the National Endowment for Democracy, it simultaneously created two different spindles, two branches of the NED, subsidiaries that are wholly funded and controlled by the NED. One was for Democrat stakeholders called the NDI, which Hunter Biden sits on the board of, and Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, runs. But it also created the RNC, the Republican branch. You can think of this like the CIA wing of the Democrat Party and the CIA wing of the Republican Party. Now, the Republican branch of the NED is called the IRI, the International Republican Institute. Who founded and ran that for 25 years? It was John McCain. So you had, and so John McCain became essentially the Republican bipartisan branch of the Soros operation. This is why you have sort of a kind of, even though Soros is known as a sort of left-wing figure, he is supported by half of the Republican Party, and he makes selective contributions and bolsters. You know, these are folks like Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's on the board of the IRI. Mitt Romney, by the way, is who ran for president for the Republican. He was the Republican Party nominee for the 2012, presidential election. And he's also the one who led the impeachment of the populist nationalist sort of representative wing of the Republican Party, Trump, during the impeachment in Ukraine over the Ukraine. Amazingly, remember, they impeached Trump because he threatened to withhold military aid to Ukraine, i.e. the exact financial investments of this same class that I just mentioned. And this also gets the Soros story in Ukraine. Who led the, so IMF, Ukraine is in debt to the IMF and the World Bank. George Soros functions as this sort of financial intermediary between what the IMF, the creditors in the IMF and the World Bank need done to get their debts repaid, and the political actions that countries need to take in order to pay off that debt. Often what that involves is privatizing industries that are held by the state, selling them, and then using the proceeds of that sale to pay off the IMF and the World Bank. Well, if the IMF and the World Bank are going to force a fire sale of a major trillion-dollar industry in that country, well, then guess what? If you are a corporation or a financial firm and you know this is going to happen, you get a bargain basement discount price to be able to swoop in and take over that industry when it undergoes that privatization. George Soros explicitly laid out in a series of documents you can look up that were called the Blue Leaks, or also called hashtag DC Leaks. These were George Soros IMF coordination documents to coordinate the sale of NAFTA gas, the privatization of NAFTA gas, in an IMF deal. To be able to turn, now again, NAFTA gas is the state gas giant of Ukraine. It is Ukraine's entire economy, okay? Ukraine's entire economy is that it runs the gas transit points from Russia into Europe, which used to be 100% of gas into Europe from World War II, essentially, up until 2022. Technically, they went through a gas diversification program in the early 2000s that the State Department coerced Europe to do, to buy more expensive American gas in order to diversify off of Russia when Putin started to use gas diplomacy to reassert Russia on the world stage. So George Soros and Vladimir Putin were locked in a death battle for control over NAFTA gas, because NAFTA gas was basically split between its board between the NATO side and the Russia side, because all of Russia's economy was based on these Russian gas transits. And so what NATO worked to do was diversify the gas transits so that they started from the Permian Basin in Houston. They were ported in through the Baltic Sea to run through terminals in Poland to connect to NAFTA gas. And so NAFTA gas would be, Ukraine would still be getting billions of dollars of gas transit money, but the starting point would be US companies and British companies rather than the Russian government. And you can argue that that's in, you know, the national interests of American citizens or British citizens. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is still a dirty tricks operation and that flies in the face of 100 years of our free trade free trade policies, if you will. But George Soros was the battering ram for orchestrating that and for privatizing NAFTA gas and prying it off of Russia. And so George Soros funding essentially the Democrat Party and funding the political operatives who are spearheading the Ukraine situation is perfect for his own financial empire, because he's the one who's investing in NAFTA gas and whose own portfolio companies and his own investment funds are invested in the endogenous gas industry in Ukraine. So he is basically bribing U.S. and British officials to take the battering ram of their military and CIA to pull off the operation that benefits his own financial portfolio companies. The last thing I'll say is you can go on my Twitter right now, at Mike Ben Cyber, type in the search bar, at Mike Ben Cyber, Soros Empire, and you will see a direct quote from George Soros himself where he is bragging on tape that he created the Soros Empire by, quote, picking up the pieces of the fading Soviet Empire to create the Soros Empire out of. So he was, you know, there's, you know, that meme, you know, of two photographs and you look at them and you say it's the same picture. When you see NATO and you see Soros, they're the same picture. When you see the U.S. State Department or the U.K. Foreign Office and you see Soros, it's the same picture. When you see the CIA or British intelligence and then you see a picture of George Soros, it's the same picture. They're one blob.
Bloody hell, Mike. That was amazing. We didn't even get a chance to get to the Hillary Clinton kill list, which I was looking forward to, particularly given that we're probably both on it. It was a great conversation.
Spit up my water.
There may be a little something extra in that water. You keep carrying on the way you are. Mike, it is always illuminating, educating, terrifying and wonderful to talk to you. Let's stay alive long enough to organise a movement that can oppose the corruption that you have beautifully and brilliantly described. Thank you for taking us to not school, university. Mike Benz's University of the Blob. Thank you, everyone. If you want to join us for conversations like that, become an awakened wonder. Put your questions to Mike. Get your diploma in understanding how this machine works. I'd like to welcome all of our new members. You can see their names on the screen now. Use the code I Surrender to be part of this movement. Unless you want to be rolled over, bowled over, and consumed by a blob that's going to devour you, remember what you have learned today. Take it forward into your day with you. We'll see you next week. Not for more of the same. We'd never insult you with that claptrap, but for more of the different. Until then, like Hunter Biden, if you can, if you can find an in, if you can find the inside information, stay free. Free as Burisma Gas Baby. See you next week. Many switches.